Thank you. Well, it's not easy being cheesy. You really, I try to milk it for all it's worth.
Oh, what would you do? Well, Cameron, how does one become a cheese specialist?
Hi, I'm Kathy Bernard.
I'm Barbara Klein. Thanks so much for tuning in.
We'll talk about Agnes, an invention that makes it easier to understand the physical challenges that come with aging.
Next, why sailors, explorers, and pirates are drawn to islands.
Then, the life and times of a top child star who played quite a popular witchy role.
Plus, how to prevent, control, and even reverse diabetes.
And the Cheese Whiz. In 1999, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology opened the Age Lab, which develops technologies that will improve health and functionality as we age. One of their inventions is the Age Gain Now Empathy System, otherwise known as Agnes, a suit that replicates what it's like to be a person in their mid-70s and the physical challenges associated with aging.
Joining us in our studios to discuss the high-tech wardrobe is Joe Coughlin, director of MIT's Age Lab. According to the Wall Street Journal, Dr. Coughlin is one of the 12 pioneers inventing the future of retirement and how we all live, work, and play tomorrow. Welcome to the show, Doctor.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, you know, in our grandparents' and great-grandparents' day in the early, 1900s, life expectancy, we hear, was under 50. But, clearly today people are living a whole lot longer, which is fabulous, as long as we're really healthy and active and we have a really good quality of life. What is the key to, aging well?
The challenge now is that I think most people believe they're going to be living longer. And the challenge now is how to live better. So it is quality of life. And it's not even being absent of disease. It's about how well do we manage those conditions that we've developed, either because we did not choose our parents wisely, or in my case, growing up outside of Philadelphia, the belief that cheese steaks and scrapple are food groups.
they aren't?
Yeah,
oh, what about
exactly.
Hot dogs?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. These things, catch up to us, we know, in terms of chronic conditions, beginning in our early 40s, when we have that checkup with a doctor that says one wheel is wobbly or one is about to fall off. And so what we're seeing now with healthy aging or the future of longevity are tools and services and products to help us manage those conditions, to help plan for where we're going to live so that we can remain active and connected with the things and people that we love.
Well, tell us about the Age Lab. This sounds so fascinating. What is it exactly?
Well, I'm really lucky to be leading a team of great students and staff that are everywhere from psychology to engineering to cognitive engineering to gerontology, of course, and a variety of other fields to invent that next 30 or 40 years that, frankly, that our parents and our grandparents never quite enjoyed. We're hoping to use technology, an understanding of human behavior, and, frankly, even a little bit of institutional reengineering to envision what is that last 30 or 40 decades going to look like as we age? How will we live, work, and play? And so we look at technology. That's certainly part of the question in terms of how do we stay independent in our homes? How do we shop for foods? How do we remind ourselves to take our medication or provide care to a loved one? But also, what's the future of fun? I mean, we rarely hear the F word associated with old age. And fun is certainly something that I think we need to think about, and it's got to be far more than a cruise ship and a card game. But also, we're finding that it's a great incentive to get people to exercise. It's a great incentive to remind them to take their meds or to become social. So the lab works with industries and AARP around the world, whether it's the auto industry, consumer products, pharma, finance, and the like.
Well, describe this Agnes for us, the suit. I love her name.
Sure.
Who came up with this brilliant idea?
Well, our staff, I think it was a joint effort. But really what Agnes is, as you noted, Age Gain Now Empathy System. You have to have a good acronym if you're going to have good technology, was a way to actually use empathy, really getting into, shall we say, the shoes of the user, the consumer, as we try to do at the lab, to understand their daily friction, fatigue, and often frustration with simple things that we think are simple when we're younger. Opening a water bottle that is now made thinner to be environmentally greener, but to an agreeing society is more likely to pop open and leak all over you because it's thinner and harder to open. Or to store aisles that are ever so tall and just happens to have the thing you need at the very top or the very bottom. And so Agnes replicates what it's like to have multiple chronic conditions like diabetes and osteoarthritis, natural aging of vision with a yellowing of the lens and lower vision and the like, the stiffness of movement and the like, that really gives the students, marketers, engineers, product designers the feeling of what it's like to open that bottle, reach to the top of the shelf, get in and out of a car. And so while you could use surveys and focus groups, and yes, you can see a lot by looking, having that aha moment wearing Agnes kind of gives that designer who knows how it can be different the aha that goes, this is not to be accepted. We can make a change.
So do you literally like zip into this suit? How does that work?
Okay, so you've got a number of components. It is a jumpsuit, in this case a solid blue jumpsuit that has a number of belts and weights and gloves that have been calibrated where we actually had occupational therapists and physical therapists work with standard numbers of what the average flexibility is for someone of a certain age or what the weaknesses are associated with certain disease at a certain age. And then we can take a 20-something and in 20 minutes we can, shall we say, bring you down to the capability of a typical poorly maintained diabetic osteoarthritis person close to 80 years old.
Okay, so let me ask you. So if you're trying to replicate like arthritis in your hands, is the person wearing these big fat gloves?
They've got gloves. They're not big and fat, but they are weighted and they are thick. So that it eliminates or reduces your tactile function, that feeling of grip that you have, but also reduces your flexibility. So you really can't get all around the pill bottle or the cake mix box. And you're using lenses that glasses that may be yellow if you're going with yellowing lens that make yellows and blues and writing more difficult, or even some lenses that we use to show low vision or macular degeneration. Mm. Your neck has a brace around it to replicate that lack of flexibility and strength. And by the way, one of the things about Agnes is although we kind of calibrated her to be in her upper 70s, low 80s with these conditions, many of these things begin to change as early as, say, 30s, your strength and your flexibility begin to diminish if you do not stay as active as you were perhaps in your 20s. You need 20 times more light to see as well at age 40 to see as well as you did at age 20. So aging is not just personal, but it's a lot more proximate than we thought.
So is this Agnes suit and the experiences that people get, is that used to help develop specific products?
Absolutely. We've used it with companies as diverse as General Mills and New Balance and Siemens and CVS to redesign spaces, places, boxes, cars, and the like. But probably the big thing that became evident to us, and I'd love to take credit that we knew this going in, we did not. But others who have visited the lab realize that it's actually a teachable moment. So while we use it as a design tool, one of the things that you do learn from having that brief intervention is that certain things like strength, flexibility, speed of movement, these things can be improved regardless of how many birthdays you've accumulated by exercise, eating well. If you want to live well in your 70s, then treat yourself well in your 60s. So Agnes was designed to be a help to engineers and marketing and product developers. But it's also now become an aha moment saying this could be your future if you keep behaving badly.
Our guest is Dr. Joe Coughlin, director of MIT's Age Lab. We are talking about how new technologies can improve health and functionality as we age. I'm Kathy Bernard, and my co-host is Barbara Klein. You can listen to the show anytime on the iHeartRadio app or at iHeartRadio.com. Now back to our conversation with Dr. Joe Coughlin. Well, doctor, who actually wears the suit? So do you have these architects and engineers climb into Agnes or they're weighted down with Agnes or whatever, and then from their experience, they specifically design and develop their products?
Basically, that is it. And our students as well. I mean, the average 20-something-year-old student often thinks that an older adult is someone who's in their 40s or maybe even 50s. And so to get into the shoes, if not the head and the like of an older adult who's experiencing what it's like to shop in a store with fluorescent lighting and high shelving or having to prepare a meal where it's hard to read the box and open the box and pour materials really is a different insight than simply asking. And the reason why it's different than asking is that we have found, and this is a little secret just between us, older adults lie. And what I mean by that is that most of us as we age say that we're coping or that we know it's difficult, but you kind of in your back of your mind, rationalize it, saying, well, you know, I'm not as strong as I used to be, so therefore it's harder. A person who's a designer or an engineer who knows how it can be changed or made easier is not going to accept that that's just the way it is. That's just a bad product. And so by slipping on the suit, which takes about 15 to 20 minutes, gives them that insight.
I think this is just fascinating.
Well, doctor, let me ask you about some specific issues associated with aging and talk about maybe how technology can help with that. You know, one of them, of course, is driving for older people. I mean, you know, it's challenging and at times it's just outright dangerous. So how can technologies help elderly people drive more safely? Is there something out there or something that you all are working on?
Certainly. I mean, the fact of the matter is the car that we are buying today is not the car that we rode in with our parents, and certainly not even the one that we're driving today. And while older drivers remains a perennial issue, birthdays do not kill. Health conditions do. And so one of the things we need to think about is how is new technology in the car going to be detecting your physical well-being behind the wheel? So in our lab, and also in some cases in the showroom of many vehicles out there, there are systems that can detect, are you fatigued? Are you stressed? In some cases, did you take your medication today? And what you're about to see are cars become what we call high-performance environments. That is, they will change their performance or warnings to bring you up if you're fatigued and to bring you down if you're stressed.
So how would it do that? Are you hooked up to something?
Well, in the lab, we hook you up. But what we're looking at are ways to, for instance, get your pulse rate off the steering wheel, to be able to detect how well your eyes are moving from infinite space outside the windshield to into the dashboard by using eye tracking. By understanding whether or not your hands are getting sweaty to indicate whether there's a little bit of stress. So the car is now about to become very much a mobile health and well-being platform that will improve your ability to drive, detect when you're deviating from a level of safety, and with any luck, be able to change so that you remain safe and mobile across the lifespan.
So this information that you get, would that be sent somewhere? Like what kind of feedback would you get from the information?
Right now, I think it's going to the car only. I think one of the things you may want to think about in the future, and I know there are privacy concerns, but for many of us, we spent upwards of just going to and from work 1 hour with our car, a 30-minute commute. Can you imagine getting a checkup once a day from your car? And maybe you do want to share that information. Maybe you don't.
Well, and if your vitals are really bad, would a car turn off suddenly?
We haven't gotten that far yet. But, you know, think about the car detecting your health and well-being and also things that are already in cars today that are, you can buy brand new, warning systems to compensate for the fact that your neck's a little stiffer and that blind spot just got a little bit bigger. If you're over 50 male, where 90% of us have a hearing impairment, we're going to have a blinking light rather than just a sound system that says that somebody's getting a little too close to you. So the car is going to be able to compensate for what you've lost or for the conditions you're managing.
Well, caregivers have an enormous and taxing job, as we all know. How can robotics and other technologies really help them perhaps provide better care or even ease their job?
Imagine this. I mean, 1 in 4 American families provide upwards of 21 hours per week of caregiving, according to the Gallup Healthways Wellbeing Index. And that's everything from the simple, taking dad to get a haircut, to far more emotional and taxing of ensuring that mom is fed or a spouse is fed at home and helping them with medications and other health conditions. And so there is a great future now with information technology that is being built in the so-called smart houses. So I think you can start planning retailers and pharmacy chains will be selling systems that will be able to remind you to take your medication or to detect not that a person has fallen, that's old news, but to detect that their walk has changed or there's something about their pattern of what they do every day has changed that may predict that they are likely to fall in the future. Yes, robotics, certainly a major new tool in the arsenal, which could be as simple as we already know to vacuuming the floor to a robot that may actually remind you to take your meds and help you take your medication or to help you get dressed. So the caregiving is going to be aided by technology. But one of the things we have found in the lab and others have found is that no matter how much technology and how much services out there, many of us, particularly adult children, don't like to delegate because we don't like to outsource our parents. So we have to find out whether our children will outsource us in the future.
And also there's the cost. I mean, this can't come cheap, all this technology.
Right. All these technologies come out at a premium price because the high tech and the high style is always at the high end of the market. The good thing is that if you take a look at things like flat screen TVs that started at thousands of dollars, you can now pick up under $1,000 for a 40-inch TV. The computer you bought in 1985 for $5,000 today has much more power and is only $400. So over time, and I know time is a big issue, but over time, these things become much, much cheaper.
Well, Doctor, do you have a favorite technology that you've developed in the Age Lab that you just think is going to revolutionize the way we age?
Well, I'm not sure it would revolutionize because, you know, aging touches so many domains from fun to finance to health and the like. But I think the big technology gains we're going to see are not necessarily in alarms or reminding you to take your medications. Those things are developing and there's, you know, many of them to choose from. But I think the technologies are going to be the real innovators are the ones that give you personalized information. So I'm particularly fond of some of the work we're doing in our aware cars that are able to detect how you are driving, how you are feeling, and then change their performance or report your performance so that you can remain mobile and safely. Or health technologies we've developed, like a smart shopping cart that takes your personalized diet and essentially allows you to go through the store aisle using barcode today or radio frequency ID tags, little computer tags on your products. Swipe it underneath this little thing. It'll say, gee, Joe, you didn't choose your parents badly. Step away from the high-salt foods and move off to something else. It'll never move you from chocolate to an apple because behavior just doesn't go that far. But it's about personalized advice about the point of decision to make the right decision at the right time.
Boy, I'd feel so bad about myself if I had that shopping cart in the grocery store.
Yeah, we ought to call it the guilt tablet.
Yeah, right. Well, Dr. Joe Coughlin, director of MIT's Age Lab, this has been fascinating and most informative. And we'd love to try on that age suit sometime.
You're more than welcome to come on up. It will be a lot of fun.
Thanks so much for sharing this great info with the two Boomer Babes.
Thank you.
There's nothing quite like the thought of escaping to an island. Sailors, explorers, and pirates have all been drawn to these small tracts of land with their rich history and spectacular beauty.
Our next guest says that large or small, flat or mountainous, barren or beautiful, far out at sea or close to shore, islands are a central part of the world we live in. They may even define what it is to be human. J. Edward Chamberlain is a world-renowned scholar and a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. He is the author of Island, How Islands Transform the World, and joins us from Canada. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Well, just how many islands are there in the world?
Somewhere between 200,000 and 2 million, depending on how we count them. But there's all those little rock outcrops around the world, especially out in the ocean. And though we might not think of them as islands, any sailor knows that they have to be charted so it doesn't bump into them. So you've got that wide range, but essentially 200,000, on which about a billion people live.
Wow. So all those people that claim they own an island, it might just be a little rock jutting out of the water, right?
It might. Although there's kind of criteria. The Thousand Islands in the St. Lawrence, they have a condition that if it's going to be mapped, the island has to be above water 365 days of the year and have a tree on it. And there's one of my favorite definitions is in the Scottish census in the 19th century, they said that to be called an island, it must have one person and one sheep on it.
Love it. Well, what is the largest island in the world?
The largest island is Greenland. Madagascar is pretty close there. Australia is often thought of as an island, but in fact it's a continent. And that designation isn't on size, but on the geology of Australia. Its rock is typical of continents, granites and sedimentary rocks, which are lighter than the basalt that is characteristic of most of the world's islands, because most of them are volcanic, and so they're a heavier basalt. So Australia gets the continent designation because of its geology, and of course also because of politics.
Okay, and what is the smallest island then?
Well, that's that rock outcrop that I'm looking out to right now on the Pacific coast. There are a handful of very small islands that count as nations in the United Nations. In fact, 11 of the world's 15 smallest countries in the United Nations are islands, including the Maldives and the Indian Ocean and Malta and the Mediterranean, several in the Caribbean, St. Kitts and Nevis, Grenada, St. Vincent and the Grenadines. So you've got all of those islands that count as nation islands, some of them very small. One called Tuvalu used to be known as the Ellis Islands in the Pacific, which is under 10 square miles in size and population just around 10,000. But it's one of the United Nations. So I'd count those as the sort of smallest considerate islands that we think of as substantial places. But we've got islands all up and down all of our coasts that are small dots with maybe a tree or two on them. And as I say, I'm looking out to several rock outcrops that the seals who sit on it would certainly call islands.
Well, islands really do have fascinating histories. I mean, the island of Hispaniola, for example, one of my all-time favorites, which was discovered by Cristobal Colon, a.k.a.
Yes.
That good old Christopher Columbus.
Yeah, yes.
So why was Hispaniola so important to the Europeans?
It was important for several reasons. One was because Columbus, when he arrived there, thought that he'd arrived at in India, essentially in the Indonesian area, he was looking for the Spice Islands, and he landed up in Hispaniola. What he found there, you're right. We all say Columbus discovered Hispaniola, but of course, what he discovered was a number of people living on Hispaniola, who'd been there on Hispaniola for probably 1,000 years. The Amerindian peoples who come there, but those islands became plantation islands essentially for the production of sugar, for some mining. Certainly on Hispaniola, there was a considerable amount of mining. They were looking for gold, but also for the minerals that were coppers and various other minerals that were sought after by Europe. And then for strategic reasons, as the years went by, to control access to the New World, essentially, because the Caribbean islands were key access points to what became the riches of the New World.
Well, Professor, you know, there's this fascination with islands. I mean, so many people have written books about it, and we all dream of, you know, the fantasy island, you know, the television show. So
yeah.
What is it about them that makes them so attractive to people?
That's the question that started me on this book. In fact, it was a sort of question posed by, of all people, Henry David Thoreau, who wrote in his journal of a week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers that an island always pleases my imagination, he said, even the smallest. As a small continent, an integral portion of a globe, I have a fancy for building my hut on one, he said. He didn't do that, but what he caught was that fascination of a place across the water, a place that we can go to and either be alone on or be with others who we think of as like-minded people on that place. But I think it's the crossing of the water that is so important. I mean, it's what defines islands, and for most of human history, crossing over to an island was a wonderful thing, but also a moderately dangerous thing to do. And it's that human instinct to take danger on and go across to a new place, to a place we haven't been, to a place that seems different.
Or exotic.
Or exotic.
Because we don't know
about it. Absolutely. And as people started to go more and more to islands, they found that they were indeed exotic. They often had animals and plants that weren't found on the mainland. And sometimes they had people who weren't found on the mainland. And that's what Columbus discovered. He discovered the Taino and Arawak and the Carib. Peoples in the Caribbean, and he realized that they lived quite different lives, and they harvested the sea and the mountainous areas of those islands like Hispaniola or Jamaica in ways that were taken on by the Spanish and then by the British and French and Dutch who went and settled in the Caribbean. But that exotic quality is absolutely crucial. We go to an island thinking, and we're usually right in thinking, that it's going to be different.
Well, Professor, having extensively studied islands, which one is your favorite?
In some ways, my favorite is the first island that I spent a lot of time on when I was 5 or 6 or 7 years old, which was just out of Vancouver up in the northwest coast on the northwest coast of Canada, and a little island called Bowen Island, Kishleel Kreen, it's called by the Salish people around here, and it was just a goofy little island that we used to paddle around and fish off and have fun on. My favorite islands now are Jamaica, certainly, where my wife is from and where we spend a lot of time. There's an island off the west coast here called the Haida Gwaii. It used to be called the Queen Charlotte Islands. It's where the Haida people, one of the great Aboriginal Indian civilizations of the northwest coast, it's their homeland, has been for thousands of years. And it's a, like many islands, it's a place of mystery and wonder and special kind of power. And like everyone else, in some ways, my favorite island is the one I'm going to go to next. I'm not sure which one that is, but it's, you know, whether it'll be, I've been there, but whether it be to Hawaii or I like the Northern Islands too, the Orkneys, those islands up in the North Sea.
Oh, you're just making me want to pack my bags.
In some ways, the favorite island for all of us is the island we dream about.
Edward Chamberlain, world-renowned scholar and author of Island, How Islands Transform the World. This has been fascinating, and we can't wait to take our next island adventure.
Thank you very much.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Up next, Bewitched. Tabitha Stevens joins us, babes. We'll be right back. Our next guest actually began her career while still in diapers at the tender age of 11 months when she appeared in a commercial for Folgers Coffee. Her next job was a detergent commercial with the future president, Ronald Reagan. But many of us remember her best for her infamous gig as Tabitha Stevens, that adorable baby featured on the top 10 sitcom, Bewitched.
50 years ago, Bewitched launched, and after 8 seasons, 23 Emmy nominations, and 254 episodes, the show gracefully ended, but its popularity endures to this day. Erin Murphy, fondly known as Tabitha, joins us on the phone to talk about this iconic show and what magic she's up to these days. Welcome, Erin.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, we hear that Entertainment Weekly and TV Guide recently touted Bewitched as one of the greatest TV shows of all time. I mean, first of all, how did you land this gig as Tabitha at the tender age of 2?
I think I was just lucky. They were looking for a baby, and I looked a lot like Elizabeth Montgomery, and I happened to have done some commercials before. And I have a fraternal twin sister, so they were mainly looking at twins for the part of Tabitha.
Oh, that's great. So you did have a little break from the set.
Just the first year. We're fraternal, so we don't really look very much alike. They would use my sister from the back or from a distance, and then I took over the role by myself through the rest of the show.
And how long did your gig actually last?
The show ran for 8 years, and I was on for the last 6.
So, Erin, what was it like growing up on the set? I mean, you were so young, maybe you didn't even know the difference.
It's funny because I basically grew up on a TV set, so it just seems like home's just part of my childhood. So everything about being on television just seemed like everyday life.
Well, what were your on-set Bewitched parents like? I mean, Elizabeth Montgomery, Dick York, and that crazy grandmother Agnes Moorehead. I mean, did they treat you like their own?
They really did. It felt like an extended family, and I was really lucky to work with such wonderful people. And we stayed in touch after the show, and just wonderful relationships I had with all of them.
Did any of their craziness, like, scare the wits out of you?
No. I think I may be the bravest girl alive, and maybe it's because I grew up around, like, animals and magic and all that, but it wasn't scary. It was really just fun.
Well, I have to ask you, Erin, did reality and, you know, your persona on the show ever kind of merge? And Offset, did you ever think you had magical powers and, like, would try to do things to your parents or your siblings, maybe?
I've only heard of one story when I was very young, and my mom asked what I wanted for breakfast, and I said, I'd like some eggs. And she said, well, we don't have eggs. And I said, I'll just twitch some up. So one time I thought I could do magic.
It didn't work, Erin.
It didn't work. And you know what? Now I have my own chicken, so now I can have eggs whenever I want.
Oh, that's perfect. Well, we read that once Bewitched ended, you were offered a role on The Waltons, but turned it down to go to Girl Scout camp. Were you just looking to be just a regular old normal kid at that point?
What happened was Bewitched wasn't canceled. We went on our hiatus expecting to come back since we were picked up for another year. And then during the break, Elizabeth Montgomery and her husband decided not to do the show again. So I left thinking I was going to camp, and I really wanted to go to camp. So I wasn't looking for another job right then. I kind of just wanted to be a Girl Scout.
Well, Erin, how did you keep it all grounded? I mean, we understand you were labeled as one of the top 10 child stars of all time. I mean, it must have been hard not to really have a big head.
I don't think so. I felt when I was very young, and still feel today, almost an obligation to be a good person. And I appreciate all the advantages and things that I've gotten from being a child actor. So I've always felt kind of grounded, and I felt a sort of responsibility to do good things and be grounded and not be someone that they, oh, well, she's on TV, she must be conceited. So I think I've gone out of the way to probably be the other way, which is how I like to live my life.
Well, that's very refreshing.
It is.
Erin, do you think it might have been a little bit different, though, if like the internet and Facebook had been around and you could Twitter things that, you know, sort of not real wholesome things that you might be doing as a teenager?
I know that with the instant social media and how everything is so readily accessible, it's probably worse for people now. But I mean, there were still, you know, all those gossip magazines and things were still around back when I was a kid. So maybe there was something I wouldn't want publicized, but probably not too much.
Well, you sure had a boatload of endorsements along the way, but one that we thought was fascinating was that there was actually a Baskin-Robbins Bewitched ice cream flavor.
That's right.
So how was that? Was it like yummy or what? I don't even remember it.
I probably don't remember it because it may have been the worst flavor in the history of Baskin-Robbins.
Oh. What was in it?
Baskin-Robbins is wonderful, and I still eat them with almond fudge. But our flavor, Bewitched ice cream, was a seasonal flavor. You know, they do promotional flavors, and we were the flavor one year for October. So they wanted to kind of tie it in with Halloween and magic, and it was vanilla ice cream with little crunchy pieces of orange and black licorice. It was really bad. Yeah, exactly.
And I'm a licorice lover. That doesn't sound so good.
I'm a licorice lover, too. It wasn't good.
Wow. Well, you know, there's a lot going on to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the show, and we hear Salem, Massachusetts is very appropriately, you know, in on the celebration. So tell us what they're doing.
I honestly don't know what Salem is doing, which is funny. I know a few years ago I helped the TV Land Network unveil a Bewitched statue of Elizabeth Montgomery. They always do magical things. I hosted their Halloween parade one year. This year I'm filming something. There's another network called Antenna TV, and they're doing the 100 episode 50-hour Bewitched Marathon, and I'm hosting it on Thursday, and it'll be airing in September. So there are a lot of different things. All 8 seasons of Bewitched are out on DVD. It's one of those few shows that we filmed in the 60s and 70s, and it's still on television, which is great.
Oh, it is great. Well, we can look forward to binging on Bewitched.
But not eating the ice cream
right.
at the same time.
Not eating the ice cream, no.
Well, Erin, beyond your amazing childhood career, you have really had an extremely active life, other entertainment areas and philanthropy and community activities, but also as a mom to 6 kids and wife to your husband, Darren. Now, are you serious? Is it really his name?
It's really his name. Poor guy gets teased a lot.
There's some karma in that, though, isn't there?
No.
I don't know.
What are the odds of that?
Not very high.
When you met him, did you think, you're Darren, this is just meant to be?
The funniest part is it didn't even register to me. All of his friends and everyone we meet comments on his name. When he told me his name, it didn't even register that it was my TV dad's name. I don't know why.
Oh, that's so funny.
Well, finally, Erin, what's next on the horizon for the former Tabitha Stevens?
I'm really, really busy. I'm doing a play right now out here in Los Angeles called Hollywood Shorts, and they're 10-minute plays written by TV writers, performed by TV actors. I'm about to start hosting a radio show for the UBN network. I'm co-owner of a company called Slim Chillers that makes frozen vodka martini popsicles.
Mm. Oh, that sounds like fun.
Wonderful.
Oh, they're really fun. And I'm in talks with the network about doing a new series that I can't talk about, but I'm very excited about.
Oh, well, we'll have to have you back.
It's a busy, busy year, which is always fun.
Actress Erin Murphy, also known as that adorable toddler witch, Tabitha Stevens. This has been great fun. Thanks so much for sharing your stories with the Two Boomer Babes.
Thanks. It was great being here.
According to the American Diabetes Association, about 26 million Americans have diabetes, which translates to just over 8% of the population. Another 79 million are pre-diabetic, placing them at serious risk of developing diabetes and heart disease. And these numbers continue to climb as Americans' waistlines continue to expand.
Dr. Osama Hamdi is an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and the medical director of the obesity clinical program at Joslin Diabetes Center. He's also the co-author of The Diabetes Breakthrough and joins us on the phone from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to the program, doctor.
Hello. Hi. How are you?
Good. So, doctor, let's start with the basics. What is the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes?
Before I start, I would like to correct one information. You mentioned 26 million was type 2 diabetes. Actually, the Center for Disease Control showed that this year it is 29. So you can see the number booming up, significantly up.
Wow. That is so scary.
Yeah. So type 2 diabetes is a commonest type of diabetes. This type of diabetes is mostly related to body weight. So people who have family history of diabetes, who gain significant amount of weight, especially around their waistline, those are the people who usually develop type 2 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease, which usually occurs in younger age. And it is because the antibodies in the body, for whatsoever reason, which we don't know, attack the pancreas, which is a gland inside the abdomen that secretes insulin. So type 1 usually treated with insulin, while type 2 should be treated primarily by weight reduction.
And is there a typical age where people develop type 2 diabetes?
It is, yeah, usually it is above age 45.
Middle-aged people.
But the scary figures that unfortunately among adolescents now we start to see type 2 diabetes.
Right.
This is an observation that was not seen in the old days, but now it is common to see younger with type 2.
Wow. So what are the complications that come from uncontrolled diabetes? What happens to the body?
Diabetes is like termites. It causes little damage over time, but this damage can be significant over years. Some of the damage, especially in type 2, is leading to heart attack. Up till now, 65 to 80% of people with type 2 diabetes die from heart attack. But there are many other complications of diabetes, like loss of vision or kidney failure, which lead to dialysis and transplant, and also a problem with the sensation in feet that sometimes lead to amputation.
I would say it's just an all-around bummer. Wow, what a bad thing.
Not a good thing.
Oh, my gosh. Doctor, you also say that at the current rate, half of all Americans will be classified as obese by 2030. I mean, that is very scary.
Yeah, the expectation is that kids born in year 2000, in their lifetime, the chances for them to develop diabetes is 1 in 3. And among Hispanic population, it will be 1 in 2.
Wow.
So you can imagine this is a problem, big problem.
Big problem. What are the chances that an obese person will actually develop diabetes?
Around 35% of obese people develop diabetes. Those are people who already have family history of diabetes. But if you look to people with type 2 diabetes, around 90% of them are overweight or obese.
Now, you know, of course, you've established that being overweight has a huge connection to potentially becoming diabetic. But how much overweight are we actually talking? I mean, are you talking 10 pounds, 20 pounds, 100 pounds?
You know, you'll be surprised that when people start to gain even little weight, while they have the genes or the inheritance of diabetes, they can develop the disease very quickly. But on the other hand, the good news is that just a 7% weight loss can change dramatically the course of diabetes or even reverse it in the very early stage.
Wow.
So if a person loses, say, that 7% of their body weight, what type of impact can they expect? I mean, can they actually reverse the diabetes?
If it is early, this is a major possibility because we know that when people gain weight, they resist their own insulin, and that's what leads to diabetes. We found in our research that when people lose 7% of their initial body weight, insulin sensitivity improves by 57%. So this is better than 2 medications for diabetes at maximum dose.
Hmm. And then you mentioned some people are more prone to getting diabetes. Is there a way to test for, is there a gene or something that you can look for to know if you, you know, should be more careful than another person?
The easiest way is to know if anyone in your family, first degree or second degree relative, has type 2 diabetes. You know that immediately you carry some inheritance. The other part is if someone during pregnancy gets gestational diabetes, what's called diabetes in pregnancy. Those people usually develop type 2 diabetes over time as well if they gain weight.
You're tuned in to the Two Boomer Babes. We're talking with Dr. Osama Hamby, the medical director of the Weight Management Program at Joslin Diabetes Center, about ways to prevent, control, and even reverse diabetes. Doctor, how important is exercise to prevent or control diabetes?
Exercise is the most important addition or lifestyle that people with diabetes should do. And especially certain types of exercise, like strength exercise, is very important for people with diabetes. Because people with diabetes lose around 1 pound of their muscle mass every single year. And that loss in the muscle mass lead to reduction, major reduction, in how much energy their body is expending. And over time, it will be a problem. So people need to increase their muscle mass, maintain their muscle mass, especially during weight loss.
You know, doctor, we know that there are so many weight loss books out there on the market. So your book is called The Diabetes Breakthrough. What distinguishes that book from other ones?
Oh, there is a big difference. Our book is based on more than 15 years of clinical research in weight management in diabetes, and also based on a program called Why Weight, which was started in 2005. And help a significant number of patients with diabetes to cut their medication down and also to maintain weight loss for longer duration. Our patients lost so far close to 9,300 pounds in the program, and they maintained around 6.4% weight loss for up to 5 years now. So we showed very long-term weight loss, which most people are challenging, and I will just to add one little point that people who are doing weight management in people with diabetes should be very careful because people with diabetes are unique in every single intervention in weight management.
And doctor, in your program, you say that people with diabetes can eat virtually any kind of food. I mean, even pasta and sweets. I mean, foods that I actually thought you had to be banned from your diet.
Let me explain. You know, the whole theory of calorie in, calorie out is not proven from clinical research to be true. What is true is that if you change your dietary composition, the macronutrients in your diet, you may lose a good amount of weight. So we are encouraging people to increase their protein intake and reduce their carbohydrate intake, but change the carbohydrates into what's called low glycemic index carbohydrates, a carbohydrate that doesn't cause increase in blood glucose. So people are eating pasta, for example, they can eat brown pasta. It has less impact. If they are eating potato, they can eat sweet potato, which has lower glycemic index and has very good impact. So they will not starve or divide themselves from what they love, but with some manipulation of their dietary composition, it works very, very well.
Well, what about sweets, doctor? Is that totally off the list, the white sugar?
You know, there are three killers in nature, the sugar, the flour, and the salt. Because they raise the blood sugar significantly up quickly, which stimulate the pancreas. As I mentioned, this is a gland that secretes insulin. And insulin is a hormone that drops the blood glucose down. So immediately, if you eat carbohydrates, in 2 to 3 hours, your blood sugar will be lower, and you will eat again, you feel hungry again, and eating carbohydrates will lead to more carbohydrates and more weight gain.
Well, and how important is breakfast?
Breakfast is very important, and many research show that people who skip breakfast start their day with lower energy expenditure, so lower metabolic rate, and they fail to lose weight in a very good way.
Finally, doctor, we only have about a minute left, but it seems like so many people can lose weight, but it's so hard to keep it off, and I'm speaking from that personally. And how does your diet plan help with that? How does it help keep the weight off?
Many research show that if you maintain higher protein, low glycemic index carbohydrate, and you increase your exercise up to 300 minutes per week, you can maintain every single pound that you lost for as long as you do it.
Okay, the good old diet and exercise.
Well, still cognitive behavior modification and medication change, which had been described in the Diabetes Breakthrough.
Well, Dr. Osama Hamdi, Medical Director of the Weight Loss Program at the Joslin Diabetes Center and author of the Diabetes Breakthrough, thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
It is my pleasure, Barbara and Kathy. Thank you very much.
Joining us to shoot the breeze with the babes is Cameron Smith, the cheese whiz from the Inn at Little Washington in Washington, Virginia. Welcome, Cameron.
Thank you so much.
So, Cameron, there's a lot of people with health issues, and they feel like they can't really tolerate cheese. So say someone is lactose intolerant. Is there any cheeses that would not make them embarrassed, shall we say?
Yes, and the really simple way to think about it is the older and the drier the cheese is, the less lactose will be in the cheese, because 98% of the lactose is found in whey. So the cheeses that are very soft, like brie and camembert and this Winamere, and those types of cheeses have more whey inside of them, so they have more lactose. But actually, to make cheeses, the cheesemaker puts in a lactic acid bacteria that actually eats lactose, and it's necessary for making cheese to convert it into lactic acid. So a hard-aged cheese like Parmigiano Reggiano is 100% lactose-free.
Okay, so I just bought like an 18-month-aged Gouda. Is that aged enough in order to avoid those problems with lactose intolerance?
Absolutely. That would be a perfect type of cheese to have.
Okay, so hard and...
Hard and dry.
Hard and dry.
Because the more moisture that's in it, the more whey is in the cheese.
Oh, God. So, this is good stuff. Okay, so what if someone's pregnant? Mm-hmm. What types of cheeses should they be avoiding? How about that?
Now, this is one that comes off quite often in the restaurant because a lot of them hear from their doctor that they can only have cheeses that are pasteurized. But the real situation is that they want to avoid all soft cheeses because the big problem with that is what's called Listeria monocytogenes, which leads to listeriosis that could lead to sepsis, pneumonia, and miscarriage for their baby. So even if a cheese is pasteurized like a poisson, it can likely become recontaminated and still have the pathogen growth, which is multiplying inside of the cheese.
Wow. Nobody ever told us that 25 years ago when we were pregnant.
Oh my gosh.
Wow. Yeah. So what about people that are gluten-free? Does cheese even have gluten in it?
There are some cheeses like a traditional Roquefort, which is made with what's called Penicillium Roqueforti, which is a rye bread mold spore made from a loaf of rye bread that was left to rot, and then they pulverize the interior into a powder, which is sprinkled into the milk. And once the cheese is pierced, and then it's allowing the cool, damp air to travel through the holes and activate the growth of this rye bread mold spore, there are traces of gluten. But there are some cheesemakers that make liquid-based mold spores, so those actually are suitable for guests that are have celiac disease or are very sensitive to gluten. And there's even some from Rogue Creamery that state on the package, gluten-free.
What would you recommend if you wanted to really make a dynamic macaroni and cheese? It's like my go-to comfort food. What would be the best cheeses
and
for that?
An out-of-the-box kind, literally.
Yeah.
Well, you could use some of the great melting Alpine cheeses. Those are cheeses such as Appenzeller and Prätzegauer and Gruyère and Leti Vase. All of those are great melting cheeses that are traditionally used in fondue. And then there's also ones like Emmentaler, which are great ones that have a piquant, sweet flavor. And you could also mix that in with a little aged Gouda, too. So,
and how much do those cheeses cost? Can you find in, you know, are they like grocery store kind of cheeses?
Some of them you can find more commodity styles of cheeses that are mass produced for a lot less, but some of the best ones that come from Switzerland that are only made up in the mountains the way that they're traditionally made, where they're eating all of the flowers and all of the herbs that give them their great complexity, those could range up to $38 a pound for some of those exquisite ones.
Ooh, that's a very expensive bowl of comfort food.
Yeah, but if you only make a pound of macaroni, you can't be using a pound of cheese. Can't maybe
you sure can. You can. That's the joy of macaroni and cheese.
So. Yes, exactly. So you'll just want to close your eyes and sigh if you try one of those with that cheese.
Well, Cameron Smith, cheese specialist, fondly known as the Cheese Whiz at the Inn at Little Washington in Washington, Virginia. Thank you so much for shooting the breeze with the babes.
Thank you very much. It was so much fun.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154. And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zimer Communications.